Sorry about the delay with that. I'm manning the board, and I'm not used to doing that. So anyway, happy birthday. We're going to read some of the birthdays for today. We've got two to tell you about. From Sioux City, Koyla Andreessen is celebrating a birthday. And in Urbandale, John A. Criswell is also celebrating a birthday. And if you're interested in the celebrity birthdays, we have singer-musician Judy Collins is 85. Rita Coolidge is 79. Actor Joanna Lumley is 78. Actor Dan Florek is 74. Photographer Sally Mann is 73. Singer-musician Ray Parker Jr. is 70. Singer-guitarist Tim McGraw is 57. Bassist D'Arcy Retzky from Smashing Pumpkins is 56. Director Wes Anderson is 55. Actor Julie Benz is 52. Actor-rapper Darius McCrary is 48. Actor Farrah Fath is 40. And actor-singer Drew Sidora is 39. And I don't know about you, but I did not know about 90% of those people. So anyway, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries.
Thank you. Patrice Lulu Des Moines passed away on April 26th after a swift and tumultuous battle with pancreatic cancer. Pat was born on May 9th of 1954 to Earl C. and Geraldine W. Lurley in Omaha, Nebraska. Pat attended Swanson Elementary School in Omaha. The Lurley family moved to Algona, Iowa in 1964, which was a rough adjustment at first for Pat, then in the fifth grade. Pat eventually made lifelong friends in Algona Middle and High School. Pat graduated from Algona High in 1972. Pat graduated from Drake University with a Bachelor of Arts in 1974. She remained a resident of Des Moines for the rest of her life. After graduating, she became a counselor at the Iowa Girls Training School in Mitchellville, where she met her future husband, Thomas J. Southard III. She then worked at Planned Parenthood of Iowa, an organization whose work she so valued as a lifelong feminist. She returned to school in 1980 to pursue a law degree at Drake Law School, graduating in 1982. Pat clerked for the Iowa State Court of Appeals from 1982 to 83 and passed the Iowa State Bar Exam in 1983. Pat then worked with Dr. Mark Raversby, practicing medical malpractice law. After several years of raising children, Pat also worked later in life at U.S. Bank as a fraud investigator. Tragedy struck the Lurley Southard family on June 20, 2017, when a house fire occurred while Pat and her daughter Jessica were visiting Pat's sister Karen in Algona, killing Jessica and Karen. Pat was devastated by the event, though she was comforted by her close relationship with her husband Tom and her remaining daughter Emily. Pat is preceded in death by her parents, Earl and Geraldine Lurley, her sisters, Karen and Kathleen, and tragically, her daughter, Jessica Southard. Pat is survived by her husband, Thomas J. Southard, and daughter, Emily, her brother, Michael B. Lurley of Lafayette, Colorado, and sons, Connor and Evan, as well as several nephews. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the charities Pat sponsored in life, Food Bank of Iowa and Iowa Legal Aid. Pat's memorial service will be held at Plymouth Congregational Church in Des Moines under the direction of her family on Saturday, May 4th at 11 a.m. A visitation will be held at the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd. Alice Singh began her next journey on April 21st. She will be greatly missed by her husband, Arvinder, known as Roger Singh. Alice loved animals and enjoyed playing bingo with her friends. Her smile and love for life will be cherished by friends, family, and all who knew her. Melvin Dean Turk, 89, of Panora, passed away April 25th. Gravesite services will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, May 8th, at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery near Van Meter. Following the services, everyone is invited to Evie's home in Waukee for fellowship. Twig Funeral Home in Panora is entrusted with his services. Dr. Ellen Patterson, M.D., 90, of Ames, passed away on April 17th. He was a physician surveyor in Knoxville and Osceola. A celebration of life service will be held at Kale Funeral Home on Sunday, May 8th at 1:30 p.m. Information is available online at Kale, that's K-A-L-E, funeralhome.com. Don Rasmussen, 87, of Webster City, died Friday, April 26th, at Crestview Nursing and Rehabilitation. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, May 3rd, at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in Webster City. Visitation will be Thursday, May 2nd, from 5 to 7 p.m., with scripture service at 6:30 p.m. at Foster Funeral and Cremation Center in Webster City. Lois A. Dickerson, 87, of Ankeny, passed away peacefully on April 23rd. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday, May 6th, at Memorial Services of Iowa, 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, May 7th, at Our Lady of Immaculate Heart Catholic Church at 510 East 1st Street in Ankeny. Lunch will be served immediately after. Lewis was born on March 31, 1937, to Arno and Mira Schaefer. She attended Green Mountain High School and graduated from AIB in Des Moines. Lewis was married to Richard L. Dickerson, who preceded her in death. She is survived by her son, John R. Dickerson, her daughter, Ann Marsh, grandchildren, John Dickerson, Brian Marsh, Holland Marsh, and great-granddaughter, Zeppelin Jackson. She is also survived by her siblings, Ann Schaefer and Artis Winters, and many beloved family and friends. In lieu of flowers, any donations in her name would be appreciated to St. Jude Children's Hospital. That's at www.stjude.org. Full obituary can be seen at memorialserviceofiowa.com. Donna Kelleher Fries of Clive was born September 20, 1932, at her grandparents' farm south of Belmont, Iowa, to Elizabeth Kelleher and James W. Kelleher of Rowan. Donna grew up in Rowan and went to Rowan Consolidated School and graduated in 1951. She moved to Des Moines shortly after graduation with a bus ticket and a silver dollar from her dad. She worked at Central Life Assurance Company until the birth of her first child, Catherine, in 1960. Dorothy married the love of her life, V. Dean Fries, also of Rowan, on February 28, 1953. They had 51 years together until his death in 2004. They lived most of their married life in Des Moines and Urbandale, with 5 years in Barrington, Illinois. After Dean retired, they moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, and Rio Verde, Arizona, where they spent 6 months of the year. They returned to Urbandale, then finally Clive, so they could be near their children and grandchildren. Donna was preceded in death by her husband Dean, daughter Catherine, parents Elizabeth and Dean Kelleher, and her stepmother Doris, brothers Robert, Larry, and Rich, and sister Diane. Left to cherish her memory are her son Brian Fries, daughter Nancy Gordon, grandchildren Ashley Bunting, Laura Thompson, Meredith McCarthy, Ben Fries, and Cody, Troy, and Tanner Gordon. She was blessed to have 9 great-grandchildren. She's also survived by her sister-in-law, Irene, Linda, and Patty Kelleher, brother-in-law, Jack Fries, and many loving nieces and nephews. Her family would like to extend a special thank you to the Woodlands Creek staff and Barb Perez for their exceptional care of Donna during her final days. Unity Point Hospice was a great comfort to Donna and her family in the last days of her life. And in lieu of flowers, any memorials to Donna can be sent to them in her name. Donna passed away peacefully on April 23rd at home, surrounded by her family. Visitation will be held from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, May 2nd at Isles Westover Chapel in Des Moines. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday at Westview Church in Waukee. Private interment will be at Graceland Cemetery in Rural Rowan. The service will be live-streamed for those unable to attend. A link will be on Donna's obituary page at islescares.com, where you may also leave online condolences. And Jackie Jolene Volk, 70, passed away April 15th, surrounded by her family at Mercy Hospital in Des Moines. Funeral services will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at 34024 Veterans Memorial Drive, Adel, Iowa, at 11 a.m. on Thursday, May 2nd. Jackie was born on December 8, 1953, in Beloit, Wisconsin, to Charles and Marilyn Howland Weaver. She married William Volk Sr. on August 21, 1971, in southern Wisconsin. Jackie's life was a testament to the power of love and compassion. She gave selflessly of herself, always putting the needs of others before her own. Her kindness and generosity left a lasting impression on all who knew her, and her spirit of caring and compassion will live on in the hearts of those she touched. She is survived by her husband of 52 years, William G. Volker Sr., son William G. Volker Jr., daughter Heidi Ellison, son Matthew Volk, grandsons Jimmy Ellison and Hunter Volk, brother Michael R. Weaver, Jamie A. Weaver, and Eric V. Kroenke. She was preceded in death by her father, Charles Rainer Weaver, mother and stepfather, Marilyn Kroenke.
And now switching over to some national news, Columbia protesters seize campus building. This dateline is New York. Columbia University severely restricted access to campus Tuesday and began suspending students involved in the Gaza war protests while demonstrators seized an academic building and blocked the entrance with human chain. Mohammed Khalil, a graduate student and lead negotiator for Columbia University apartheid divest, in almost 2 weeks of talks with the administration, returned to campus Tuesday morning to find he was suspended and his ID card blocked. Negotiations ended without an agreement Monday. "This goes against the norms. I was not a part of this encampment," Khalil told the USA Today, standing outside campus gates. "Yet again, this shows the randomness and the arbitrary measures the university is taking against students." The academic building, Hamilton Hall, is a short walk from where demonstrators protesting Israel's war in Gaza have occupied an encampment that for 2 weeks has been the epicenter for campus protests nationwide. Shortly after 12:30 a.m., students broke into the building and barricaded themselves with wooden chairs, metal tables, and trash cans. An autonomous group of students reclaimed the building as Heinz Hall in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old girl from Gaza. Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine said in a social media post, "We continue to stand in solidarity with Palestinian liberation." The demonstrators released people, including workers who were inside at the time of the takeover. A Heinz Hall banner flew from a window in the building as supporters linked arms to form a line protecting the entrance while others demonstrated leading chants to support of Gaza. Effective immediately, access to the main campus has been limited to students residing in residential buildings on campus and employees who provide essential services to campus buildings, labs, and residential student life, the school said in a statement. "The safety of every single member of this community is paramount." Columbia protesters demand the school halt investments with companies profiting from Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, and they want amnesty for students and faculty involved in the protest. College campus demonstrations have been fueled by the civilian toll in Gaza, where more than 34,000 people have died since the Israeli invasion in response to a Hamas-led attack that killed almost 1,200 people in Israel. Blocks surrounding the Manhattan School were a maze of metal barricades Tuesday afternoon as the administration's closure of campus dragged on. The Columbia University Apartheid Divestment Group said that negotiations between administrators and the students occupying the building had stalled by the afternoon, and that demonstrators were worried about the university calling in riot police. Columbia spokesperson Ben Chang said protesters chose to escalate actions to an untenable situation by vandalizing property, breaking doors and windows, and blocking entrances to Hamilton Hall. Students occupying the building face expulsion, Chang said in an update. Protesters were informed that their participation in the encampment violated numerous university policies. We gave everyone at the encampment the opportunity to leave peacefully. Students who didn't commit to terms, which were distributed Monday, are now being suspended. Seniors are ineligible to graduate. Commencement ceremonies are still set for May 15th. This is about responding to the actions of the protesters, not their cause, Chang said. White House spokesman John Kirby said the Biden administration was monitoring the escalating protests on U.S. campuses. The president believes that forcibly taking over a building on campus is absolutely the wrong approach. This is not an example of peaceful protest, Kirby said at a briefing. White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates said in a statement that Biden respects freedom of expression but believes protests must be lawful. Forcibly taking over buildings is not peaceful. It is wrong. And hate speech and hate symbols have no place in America, Bates said. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, speaking at a Senate budget hearing Tuesday morning, said, "What's happening on our campuses is abhorrent." Cardona said his agency has more than 100 pending civil rights investigations concerning allegations of discrimination, including anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim harassment at Columbia. Hate has no place on our campuses, and I'm very concerned with the reports of anti-Semitism, he said. A video that surfaced of a woman's hijab being forcefully removed during a pro-Palestine rally at Arizona State University on Saturday drew a sharp rebuke from Muslim leaders. The video, posted on social media platform X by ABC 15 reporter Dave Biscobing, shows the woman, one of nearly 70 people arrested during the rally, sitting near a bus, apparently handcuffed. The video, which is censored, showed four officers surrounding her as her headscarf is removed. This is a gross violation of the religious rights of peaceful protesters, said Aza Abusev, executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Arizona. A hijab is a garment that covers the head and wraps around the neck as a symbol of modesty and piety. Its removal is a violation of one's privacy and identity, Abusive said. You feel violated, you're hurt, and it's dehumanizing.
New York judge rules Trump violated a gag order. The ninth day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial started with a slap on the wrist from Judge Juan Merchan. Merchan said Trump violated a gag order nine times and would be fined $1,000 per violation. As directed, Trump's Truth Social account then removed posts that Merchan ruled were in violation, including attacks on former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, potential jurors, other witnesses, and prosecutors. The gag order forbids Trump from commenting on potential witnesses except in response to attacks. There will be a hearing later this week to address four new alleged violations. In good news for the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, he may attend his son Barron's Florida high school graduation on May 17th, Merchan said. Prosecutors said Trump falsified business records to hide a conspiracy to unlawfully interfere with the 2016 election by authorizing $130,000 in hush money payment from Cohen to adult film actor Stormy Daniels. Daniels claims she and Trump had sex in 2006. Trump denies her claim and has pleaded not guilty to the charges. As usual, Trump sought to put his own spin on events. Before entering the courthouse, he criticized campus Israel Hamas protests, said he'd much rather be in Georgia, and urged reporters to read his Time interview in which he outlined plans for a second term. Also, as usual, he complained about the judge, the trial, and the chilly courtroom, where he was accompanied for the first time by a family member, his son Eric Trump. The two core witnesses of the day were members of classically New York professions, finance and law. The prosecution picked up where it left off Friday, questioning banker Gary Farrow about arrangements that Cohen, then his client at First Republic Bank, made for the payment to Daniels. In October 2016, Cohen asked Farrow to immediately open an account for a new limited liability company for his real estate investment consulting, according to Friday's testimony. It didn't raise alarms for Farrow, he said. But prosecutors say it was a shell company to pay Daniels the $130,000. If Farrow had known the truth, the transfer would have proceeded much more slowly, if at all, he said Tuesday. Transferring the money on behalf of a political candidate would have triggered additional due diligence on the bank's part, Farrow said. Paying an adult film star would certainly have delayed the transaction, and it's possible the bank wouldn't have approved the wire transfer at all, out of reputation concerns, Farrow said. And he testified that he generally didn't assist clients with shell companies except to maintain anonymity for owning a home, boat, or plane. In cross-examination, Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanche got Farrow to confirm that nothing about Cohen's new account raised a red flag. That might be groundwork for the defense team to later argue to the jury that the banker saw no red flags at the time, so why would Trump? Two other witnesses testified briefly. Questioning Robert Browning, an executive director of C-SPAN's archives, prosecutor Rebecca Mangold played several video clips of Trump denying different women's claims. Quote, I have no idea who these women are, Trump said in one clip, and the stories are total fiction. They're 100% made up. They never happened, end quote. The videos didn't make clear what allegations he was denying. Philip Thompson, who works for a court reporting company, spoke about a Trump deposition that touched on the infamous Access Hollywood tape. Then lawyer Keith Davidson, who represented both Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal in their hush money negotiations, took the stand. McDougal also alleges she had an affair with Trump, which he denies. The messy highlight of Davidson's testimony was a series of texts between him and Dylan Howard, then editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer, about the two women's stories. I have a blockbuster Trump story, Davidson texted about McDougal's account. Howard responded, Talk first thing. I will get you more than anyone for it. You know why, ... end quote. Davidson pressed him, Don't forget about Cohen. Time is of the essence. The girl is being cornered by the estrogen mafia. Forced to explain that comment, David said it was very unfortunate and regrettable, and said he thought he'd adopted the term from one of McDougal's associates. He said there were several women leaning on his client to sign a deal with ABC News. During the negotiations, Howard texted Davidson, We are going to lay it on thick for her. Quote, Good, throw an ambassadorship for me. I'm thinking of the Isle of Man, Davidson joked. He confirmed to prosecutor Joshua Steinglass that he understood the hush money deal would benefit Trump's campaign. The testimony moved on to Daniels. Davidson said he represented her as early as 2011. However, it wasn't until the Access Hollywood tape came out in 2016 that there was a crescendo of interest in her story. In the hush money deal, Davidson used pseudonyms for Daniels and Trump, he said.
Four officers killed, four hurt in North Carolina shooting. Four law enforcement officers were killed and four others were injured on Monday when gunfire erupted at a house in Charlotte, North Carolina, where authorities first arrived to serve a warrant. The suspect who fired at officers was fatally shot on the lawn of the house, while two other people inside the home were taken in for questioning. At least one of them is believed to have shot at law enforcement. In the hours since, condolences for the officers involved in one of the deadliest recent attacks on law enforcement stretched from the local community to the White House. They are heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, rushing into harm's way to protect us, President Joe Biden said in a statement Tuesday. We mourn for them and their loved ones, and we pray for the recoveries of the courageous officers who were wounded. Biden said he and First Lady Jill Biden will be praying for the families and the recovering officers. The president also spoke with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles to express his condolences and support for the community. Biden added, more needs to be done to protect law enforcement. That means funding them so they have the resources they need to do their jobs and keep us safe. And it means taking additional action to combat the scourge of gun violence. Around 1:30 p.m. Monday, officers with the U.S. Marshals Task Force arrived at a home in a suburb of Charlotte to serve several active warrants against 39-year-old Terry Clark Hughes, Jr., who was wanted for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon and two counts of fleeing to elude, according to Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Armed with a high-powered rifle, Hughes fired upon the approaching task force officers, striking several of them, police said. Officers called for backup, and as additional law enforcement responded to the scene, the gunfire continued, striking additional officers, the department said. Authorities eventually shot Hughes, who was pronounced dead, on the front lawn. At least 12 Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers fired their weapons during the incident, all of whom are on paid administrative leave, the department said in a statement Tuesday. Police then began negotiations with other people in the home before authorities eventually sieged the house with armored vehicles, a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle, a 40 caliber handgun, and additional magazines and ammunition for the weapons were found at the scene. Two women were brought in for questioning after they exited the house, the police department said in a statement. Investigators are not looking for any other suspects or persons of interest in the case, according to the police department. Eight officers, four from the United States Marshals Fugitive Task Force and four from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, were shot in the incident. Of the officers who were killed, three were from the task force and the other was from the police department. Two of the slain task force members, Sam Peloach and Alden Elliott, were employed by the state's Department of Adult Corrections for 14 years, a statement from the department said. Peloach is survived by his wife and two children, according to the state's correction department. Elliot was married and had one child. Both were pronounced dead at a hospital. U.S. Marshals Deputy Thomas M. Weeks, age 48, of Moorville, North Carolina, was killed in the shooting, the agency said. Weeks, a husband and father of four children, was a 13-year veteran of the Marshal Service. After hours in the hospital, Joshua Ayer, a 6-year veteran of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, died from his injuries. Ayer was married and has a 3-year-old son. He fought for several hours and passed away from the injuries with his wife and family by his side tonight, Johnny Jennings, chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, wrote on X. Sang Young, age 54, was just leaving his house shortly after 1 p.m. when members of the Marshall Task Force raced into his yard, taking cover behind a powder blue Honda sedan. As gunfire began blasting through the yard of the two-story home next door, Choan began live streaming to his Facebook from his iPhone. Choan said he watched as one and then another officer was hit by gunfire from the rear of the brick home and heard the frantic calls for assistance. Hughes had served time in prison following multiple felony convictions. In 2010, he served 6 months in prison after he was convicted on a felony breaking and entering charge related to an incident that occurred the year before, according to North Carolina Department of Adult Correction. In June 2012, he was arrested on charges of speeding to elude arrest. At the time, he was the subject of several active warrants. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Cecilia Bonetti. It's been a pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels and Pam Rhodes. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Pamela with our first article.
Biden misses chance to decry anti-Semitism. President Joe Biden was asked the following by a reporter last week. Mr. President, what's your message to the protesters? Do you condemn the anti-Semitic protests on college campuses? Biden answered, I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians and how they're being. The president didn't complete his thought. His absent-mindedness has come to be expected these days. Yet that's not why his comment is most alarming. What stands out is the blatant hypocrisy of Biden's words. Conservative commentators called out Biden for having a fine people on both sides moment, and I agree. In case you have forgotten, then-President Donald Trump made the both sides comment in August 2017 when neo-Nazis and white supremacists descended on Charlottesville, Virginia. A white supremacist purposely ramming his car into a crowd killed a woman and injured 35 people who were there to counter-protest the racist demonstration. It was a terrible incident, one that demanded a response from the president. Yet it took Trump several days before he would condemn those responsible by name. Then the next day, he negated his strong statement by pointing to how there were fine people on both sides. Trump was roundly criticized for his response, as he should have been. It was an ugly, inane attempt to downplay the threat of neo-Nazis, presumably for political reasons. Now Biden is the one who deserves strong criticism. The campus protests that have intensified deserve no support from the president. Recent pro-Palestinian encampments at colleges around the country, many at the most elite schools in the nation, have proved to be vile, anti-Semitic, and even violent. Jewish students and faculty have been targeted, harassed, and assaulted simply for who they are, and many feel afraid to set foot on their campuses. And college administrators have proved woefully inept at enforcing their own codes of conduct and quelling this blatant hatred toward Jews. While students have become increasingly bold and obnoxious, anti-Semitic rhetoric has roiled campuses since October 7, when Hamas brutally attacked Israel, murdering at least 1,200 people and kidnapping hundreds of hostages. Horrific messages quickly surfaced at colleges, with students and professors openly embracing Hamas, a terrorist group, as liberators of overcoming their Israeli oppressors. Kafieth clad and mask wearing college students have shouted slogans such as, "We are all Hamas and long live Hamas." A protester brought a Hezbollah flag, another terrorist group, to a demonstration at Princeton. A student responsible for organizing the Columbia University encampment, Kamani James, said such disgusting things as, "Zionists don't deserve to live." James, who was banned from the campus after his comments went viral, also said, "Be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists." The hatred and violence have gone in one direction, against Jews and anything to do with Israel. Actual terrorists such as Hamas and their sponsors in Iran have even praised the college students for staging protests, a fact that should embarrass and shame these privileged young Americans and their enablers. Surely there's not much here for Biden to equivocate over. Biden has said that the white supremacist protest in Charlottesville and Trump's botched response persuaded him to run for president in 2020. He made it a central part of his campaign announcement in April 2019, calling out the fangs of racism and the same anti-Semitic and racist herd across racist bile heard across Europe in the 1930s and 40s. And of course he invoked Trump. And that's when we heard words from the President of the United States that stunned the world and shocked the conscience of our nation. He said there were some very fine people on both sides. With those words, the President of the United States assigned a moral equivalence between those spreading hate and those with the courage to stand against it. Now President Biden has committed the same error. The hate and ignorance spewing from the mouths of these college students deserve only one response: condemnation. The campus protests could have been made a distinction between carrying about and trying to help innocent people in Gaza and the terrorists who brought on this war through their barbaric attack. But they haven't, and in many cases they've doubled down on anti-Semitism. Don't expect Biden to change course, though. He's petrified of losing the Palestinian vote. I guess it's not easy to take the moral high ground when you have votes to woo 6 months before an election. This article was written by Ingrid Jacques. It was a columnist at USA Today, and you can contact her at ijacques@usatoday.com or on X, formerly Twitter, @Ingrid_Jacques.
Thank you, Pam. The next editorial is by Sarah Pequeno. Militants for Rising Campuses Won't Stop Protests. I took the train up to Columbia University last week to see the depraved New York college students everyone keeps saying are taking over their college campuses. According to social media and news coverage, these students are single-handedly driving our country into chaos by protesting, something that college students have done for decades. Behind the gate and in pockets along the campus perimeter, pro-Palestinian students wore keffiyehs, the traditional Palestinian scarves, and waved the Palestinian flag. There was a group of interfaith believers huddled and chanting just off the sidewalk. Nearby were members of Neturi Karta, an Orthodox Jewish group that opposes the State of Israel. Pro-Israel counter-protesters were marching down the streets, making their presence known to the students behind the gates. At one point, I watched as a group of students waved the Palestinian flag over one of Columbia's gates and argued with pro-Israel demonstrators. "You're a Nazi," one pro-Israel protester yelled. "You're all Nazis." Pro-Palestinian demonstrators have been accused of anti-Semitism. On April 21st, the Sunday before Passover, a rabbi who works for Columbia told hundreds of Jewish students via WhatsApp that the university had failed to guarantee their safety and urged them to return home the following day Columbia moved classes online. But I didn't see violence, out-of-control students, or chaos on my visit. What I saw were people on either side of the argument saying exactly how they felt about the Israel-Hamas war and an Ivy League school that doesn't know how to deal with it aside from militarization. For months, there have been protests calling into question U.S. support of Israel. Across the country, demonstrators have blocked roadways, disrupted speeches, and boycotted products. Some of the most vocal dissidents have been on college campuses. Over the past 2 weeks, students at more than 30 campuses have held demonstrations. This has led to hundreds of arrests across the country. Earlier in April, Columbia University called the New York Police Department on demonstrators who had set up an encampment. More than 100 people were arrested. Since then, protests at Yale University, the University of Minnesota, and New York University have led to mass arrests. People have shown up at multiple schools in riot gear. At the University of Texas at Austin, the administration called in state troopers. This has not stopped students across the country from creating encampments, both in solidarity with the students at Columbia and in protest of the ongoing conflict that has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians after more than 200 days of war. Instead of focusing on the destruction we're witnessing in real time, the administrations of these universities are choosing to reprimand students. On Monday, Columbia announced it began suspending students hours after demonstrators defied a deadline for clearing the Gaza Solidarity encampment at the center of campus. Tuesday, it shut down the campus after protesters seized an academic building. Law enforcement was everywhere at the protests I visited, with NYPD officers and private security guarding the entryways. I understand that they are expected to be there. I'm just not sure it can lead to any genuine resolution. Nothing will escalate a situation more than introducing police in riot gear with zip ties at the ready. Nonviolent protest does not need to be met with weaponry. I do not know why university administrations continue to act as if this will accomplish something, considering there have been so many times before this where it hasn't. The Columbia administration's response harks back to its actions in 1968 during the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement, when the NYPD arrested and violently removed more than 700 protesters who had seized university buildings and temporarily took a dean hostage. The university eventually ceded to the demands and severed ties with the Pentagon Institute, but it did not change what these students endured to get their message across. What university administrators across the country need to realize is that time isn't on their side. History will remember the way school officials called the police on their students. It's wild to see a group of people be so committed to villainizing themselves in the eyes of their students and the general public. I have repeatedly said that Gaza will be one of the top issues of the presidential election. What we're seeing on college campuses is proof of that. It is consistent with the polling we've seen that shows Generation Z is sympathetic to the Palestinian struggle. And it is consistent with the surge of uncommitted votes we've seen in the Democratic primaries. It shouldn't be surprising that this generation is mobilizing against the Israel-Hamas war that, in part, is funded by U.S. tax dollars. An entire generation is telling you exactly how they feel about financially supporting war, An entire generation is telling you exactly how they feel about financially supporting war, and I don't think they'll be backing down anytime soon. And this is, she's the elections columnist, Sarah Pequeno, and she's on X, formerly Twitter, at Sarah Pequeno, and Facebook, Facebook.com, Pequeno Writes.
We're turning now to sports, and here are the sports on TV for today. All these times are Eastern Time Zone. Basketball, National Basketball Association, 7:30 p.m., TNT, Miami at Boston, 8:30 p.m., NBAT, New Orleans at Oklahoma City, that's at 10 p.m., TNT, Dallas at LA Clippers, and baseball, Major League Baseball, 1:10 p.m., MLBN, St. Louis at Detroit, MLBN, Tampa Bay at Milwaukee, 2:10 p.m., MLBN, Minnesota at Chicago White Sox, 3:07 p.m., ESP Plus, Kansas City at Toronto, 6:35 p.m., AMZP/MLBN, New York Yankees at Baltimore, 6:40 p.m., MLBN, Colorado at Miami, 8:10 p.m., MLBN, Cleveland at Houston, 9:40 p.m., MLBN, Los Angeles Dodgers at Arizona.
Iowa high school stars shine at Drake Relays, written for us by Alyssa Hartel of the Register. Record-shattering performances, standout seniors, and no shortage of surprises. That was the story of the Drake Relays, impacted by severe weather delays on both Friday and Saturday for Iowa high school athletes. But those same high schoolers forged ahead, changing prom plans and running races with limited to no warm-ups in hope of taking taking home a Relays title. Now the focus shifts to the Iowa High School State Track and Field Meet. Technically, teams and athletes will still need to qualify for state through meet scheduled for Thursday, May 9th. But based on last week's performances, some athletes should be a shoe-in for the state meet. Here are four things to consider after Drake Relays and ahead of the Iowa State Track and Field Meet. The Tigers senior distance runner didn't even look like she broke a sweat as she claimed the white flag in both the 3,000-meter and 1,500-meter runs. Darnkamp entered the weekend without a win at the Drake Relays and left after becoming the fifth high school girl ever to sweep the distance events. Oh, and she crushed some records in the process. Darnkamp finished the 3,000-meter run in 9 minutes, 23.69 seconds. That time set not only a Drake Relays record, but an all-time Iowa record as well. Her time on Thursday was nearly 20 seconds faster than the rest of the field, truly putting Darnkamp in a league of her own this season. After helping Valley to a fourth-place finish in the 4x800-meter relay, Darnkamp spent much of the time in between that race and the 1500, thinking the latter event wouldn't happen. But after a three-hour severe weather delay, Darnkamp took the track with just 30 minutes to warm up. Once again, the Valley star separated herself from the crowd. Darnkamp finished the 1500 in 4 minutes, 26 seconds, another relay's record. That time was 6/10 of a second slower than the all-time best record in Iowa. So it's safe to assume that Darnkamp will have her mind on that heading into the state track meet. Speaking of success after the severe weather delay, the ADM boys relay team for the 4x100 put together an impressive performance on Saturday night. Their fastest time this season came not too long after enjoying some orange chicken from Panda Express. The sprinter ahead of Aiden Flora, Tyler Gelhar, Zach Lohman, and Bevan Dahl fueled up on fast food. American Chinese cuisine hurried back to Drake Stadium where it was announced the meet was restarting, grabbed their spikes, and took to the track. ADM finished first in the finals after running a second-best 41.79 seconds in the prelims. Their finals time of 41.38 seconds is the fastest in the state this season and the second-best time all-time in Iowa. Ankeny's relay team was the favorite to win entering the relays, and let's be real, the Hawks are very much still capable of winning that event at the state meet in a couple of weeks, but the Tigers won't go down without a fight. ADM's new pre-race routine might be unconventional, but it worked once. Maybe it could work again. The Warriors senior entered the relays as another top athlete competing in several events. She left after claiming two white flags and making her name known. Carter edged out Clear Lake's Reese Brownlee, the favorite, to win the 400-meter dash. She won the relays title with a time of 55.45 seconds, the current best in the state this season. Her second win came with Waukee's 800 sprint medley relay team. The Warriors beat out the other competitors by running the event in 1 minute 46.53 seconds. Carter didn't take home any more titles, but that doesn't mean she didn't help Waukee into the top 10 in order in other events. She anchored both the 4x400 and 4x100 relays, with the Warriors finishing second in the former and sixth in the latter. Those performances helped Waukee to a second-place finish in the team race, 7 points behind Pleasant Valley, which won both of the 4x400 and 4x800 and finished second in the sprint medley. Ankeny won the team title after finishing first in the 4x100-meter relay, second in the distance medley relay, and fourth in the 4x100. But anyone who's seen the 4x100 squad of Caden Hankey's Logan Fairchild, Devin Akers, and Jackson Belding knows they can pull off more than a fourth-place finish on the Blue Oval. The severe weather delay definitely prevented some what-if-type questions. The state track and field meet could be the answer to whether Ankeny, as a whole, is the top boys' team in Iowa this year.
Drake gets 6'8" forward Mattioni. Ben McCollum officially added his first high school signer to the Drake men's basketball roster Monday morning. Joey Mattioni, a 6'8", 250-pound senior from Overland Park, Kansas, originally committed to and signed with McCollum's Northwest Missouri State squad, but the soon-to-be high school graduate opted to follow McCollum to Des Moines. Mattioni helped Blue Valley Northwest High School to a state championship in 2023 and earned first-team All-State honors. He averaged 19.1 points, 8.91 rebounds, 2.1 assists, and 1.6 steals per game in his senior season, according to KCHSHHoops.com. Mattioni is the sixth player and the first high schooler to commit to McCollum since he took over as the Bulldogs head coach. He joins Northwest Missouri State transfers Bennett Sturts, Isaiah Jackson, Daniel Abur, Indiana State transfer Eli Shetlar, and Wyoming transfer Cameron Maniawu. And just a quick article before we go to Dear Abby. James quiet about future after Lake's playoff loss. LeBron James wouldn't address his future plans in the wake of the Los Angeles Lakers season-ending loss on Monday. Shortly after the host Denver Nuggets edged Los Angeles 108-106 on a late tie-breaking basket by Jamal Murray to end their first round Western Conference playoff series in five games, James was asked if there was any thought he might have played his last game with the Lakers. James paused a long time before replying, I'm not going to answer that. Now, turning to Dear Abby, workplace crush leaves woman struggling to move forward. Dear Abby, I am a lesbian who recently experienced heartbreak by falling in love with my mentor and boss. I didn't want it to happen, but it did. The time we spent together was a balance of bliss and fear. My heart and soul feel that she feels the same way about me. I left my job because my feelings for her became so overwhelming I could no longer cope. She knows how I feel about her, and she has shown interest in me in the past. She is not gay, but I do not know of a straight woman who has fallen in love with one woman in their lives. We have a 15-year age difference. That doesn't matter to me. I'm absolutely crazy about her. I dream about our Victorian home together and a beautiful garden and life. I want nothing else but to make her happy for the rest of her life, make her breakfast every morning, and beautiful dinners every night. We are no longer communicating upon her request. I want to heal my heart and live my life. It's so hard to let go of her, but I know I should. On the other hand, something tells me I should wait for her. How can I move forward and find the love I deserve in this life? Signed, Crushed in California. Dear Crushed, if you really want to find the love you know you deserve, then you are going to have to find someone who is ready and willing to provide it. This person is not. She was interested in you only as a friend and an employee. Asking you to stop communicating with her was a strong message. It may take time and even psychological counseling to help you disengage from your fantasy of an idealized life with this woman. But for the sake of your sanity, it's important that you try. Dear Abby, my son got his girlfriend pregnant. She already has a 7-year-old by another man. Her mother kicked her out and the baby right after the baby was born. She had no other place to go, so I had her, her child, and my grandbaby stay with my husband and me. What a big mistake that was. All we asked of her was to clean up a bit around the house. She lives here rent-free. She buys her food and will cook sometimes for herself and her children, but she leaves the pots and pans and dishes for me to do. She won't lift a finger to any household chores. She works only part-time, and I watch both kids when my son can't. Am I wrong to be angry that she won't help out? Signed, Doing It All in Pennsylvania. Dear Doing It, I'm glad you asked. This appears to be an example of no good deed goes unpunished. That said, you are wrong to be angry at your son's girlfriend. You should be angry at yourself for tolerating her selfish behavior. She and your son should be working toward being independent. They are a family now. Lay down the law to your son and this woman. Tell them exactly what you expect of both of them, and if they don't comply, they will have to make other living arrangements. Then enforce the rules. If you do, you will be doing all of you a favor. And that is, you can contact Abby at www.dearabby.com.
Thank you, Pam. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Cecilia Bennett. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.